All right, it's time now on the Talking Information Center to begin the reading of today's Boston Globe for Monday, the 8th of June, 2026, and we say hello to Grant.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. Here comes summer, or so they say. It's supposed to be a very summery week. Let's hope so and enjoy it. Take a look at today's Globe, and from above the fold, we start with a story. Staffers filed ballot papers for candidates. Mix of political and public work raises legal questions. It's an article by Chris Van Buskirk, and we take it from here. Over the course of several weeks this spring, at least seven public employees working under Secretary of State William F. Galvin popped into city or town halls on weekdays to file paperwork to help get the eight-term incumbent back on the ballot. For House Speaker Ron Mariano, it was his chief of staff who helped handle the political task. For State Auditor Diana DeZoglio, an intern in her taxpayer-funded office chipped in. Four raids to Attorney General Andrea Campbell, including the office's top communications official, submitted documents to help ensure that she could run for re-election. The campaign work, their offices said, was all within legal bounds. Their employees used their own vacation, personal, or comp time to help their elected bosses, oftentimes when they would otherwise be working their taxpayer-funded jobs. Several elected officials said they did not ask the employees to help, nor was the campaign work required as part of their official duties. But public employees' decision to pitch in on their bosses' re-election campaigns can create a delicate dance to avoid illegally mixing political and public work. And staff performing the campaign tasks can nonetheless create uncomfortable optics for the elected officials, according to political watchers. It feels a bit off to have your employees helping you get set up for your next campaign, said Ray La Raja, the co-director of UMass Amherst poll. First, because I wonder about how voluntary it is that your boss. And second, it just seems a bit of a conflict of interest for the person doing it, because they're going to benefit directly from their boss staying in power. The Globe reviewed the so-called nomination papers. Excuse me here. I apologize. One page off. I'll get it for you. Well, they reviewed the so-called nomination papers at the time, and I apologize. We're going to find this story if it's the last thing we do. Hold on 1 second. If anyone can find page A6, give me a call, because I know it's right in front of me. It just is avoiding me like the plague here. Hold on a sec. A7, A8. Oh, this is fun. We have to do this again real soon. We'll keep after it. Let's see. A3, A4, A5, A6. There it is. And we continue. Oh, wasn't that fun? So, public employees filing ballot papers for some incumbents. I should have had somebody in here helping me find the newspaper. Guess we'll have to move forward on our own. Anyways, so the campaign submitted to more than 40 cities and towns across Greater Boston and in other cities, including Springfield, New Bedford, Pittsfield, and Worcester. Municipal clerks are responsible for verifying the signatures turned in by campaigns before candidates, including statewide incumbents, can qualify for the September primary ballot. Massachusetts law bars elected officials from using public resources for election-related purposes. Unelected public employees also cannot engage in campaign work on public time. This according to the State Ethics Commission. Employees from across several offices took steps not to cross those lines, their offices said. In some cases, spokespeople for Galvin and Campbell said the workers dropped off campaign documents during their unpaid lunch breaks. Others took vacation days. One employee in Galvin's Boston office used sick time from his job the same day he submitted signatures for Galvin in a city where he didn't live. Campbell, Galvin, DeSoglio, and others all face no primary challenges, and some have significant campaign resources. Galvin had stockpiled more than $2 million in his campaign account, while Campbell had $811,000 at the end of last month. Campbell also employs multiple staffers on her campaign who regularly dropped off nomination papers with local clerks this year. Galvin files signatures himself multiple times and in other instances relied on volunteers, according to review of local records. Other statewide officials, such as Governor Maura Healey, largely used campaign workers, Democratic Party staff, or volunteers, or their campaign mailed in nomination papers to get their signatures, records show. Galvin has faced criticism in the past after public employees in 2018 filed nomination papers on his behalf. An internal review that year found that 3 of 19 employees identified by the Globe as submitting documents for him likely did the campaign work during work hours. Both Galvin and Campbell declined interview requests for this story. The 4 public staffers in Campbell's office who dropped off signatures did so between March and May at towns stretching from Milton to Natick, records show. Campbell's office said the work was voluntary and conducted on employees' personal time. One of Campbell's top aides, communications director Molly McGlynn, submitted signatures at 3 town halls on May 1st, including before noon in Natick, when her timesheet showed she logged a 7.5-hour workday. McGlynn worked substantially more that day and was not on paid time when she dropped off the documents, according to Campbell's office, which described her as an exempt employee who is not required to work standard hours and does not need to take time off so long as 7.5 hours of work are completed in a day. Adelaide Pagano, an assistant attorney general in Campbell's Consumer Protection Division, filed election papers in Dedham on March 20th during what Campbell's office said was her lunchtime. 2 other special assistants in the office submitted signatures on a day that records show they took personal or vacation time. At least 2 employees in Galvin's Boston office dropped off paperwork for the secretary, though each of them either used a vacation day, a personal day, or visited a city hall after 6 p.m., according to timesheets provided by Galvin's office. One of the employees, Calvin Brown, who works as an election specialist and also is a Chelsea City Councilor, submitted nomination papers for the secretary in Melrose on March 18th, the same day he used 7.5 hours of sick time, records show. Brown did not respond to multiple emails and phone calls. and at least 5 staffers in registries of deeds, which fall under Galvin's supervision, also submitted signatures for him, the Globe found in its review. That includes 2 elected officials, Suffolk County Register of Deeds, Stephen Murphy, and Berkshire County Register of Deeds, Patsy Harris, who filed signatures in Boston and Pittsfield on workdays in March. Though as elected officials, they do not file hourly timesheets. Murphy did not respond to requests for comment. When contacted, Harris told a Globe reporter she would call back as soon as I clear my office. She did not respond to follow-up calls or messages. Tyler Carlton Kelly, who works at the Southern Essex Registry of Deeds and also serves on the Democratic State Committee, visited the Lynn and Salem City Halls at least 3 times in March and April to drop off nomination papers on Galvin's behalf, this according to public records. He said he was never asked by Galvin's campaign to drop off papers and took those days off. I was just willing to do it, Carlton Kelly said. This is something I just care about and enjoy doing. Dan Ehrman, a Northeastern University professor who focuses on politics and the law, said it's not surprising that people who work for elected leaders are also their political supporters. But he said the activities might be questionable in the eyes of the voting public. It's one of those things where the line between law and politics gets blurred, Ehrman said. An intern submitted signature papers at 2:51 p.m. on April 27th at Boston City Hall for DiZoglio, the first-time state auditor. The intern's timesheet shows they worked 7.5 hours that day, but Michael Luong Tot, DiZoglio's general counsel, said the part-time college student erroneously logged hours for that day when they actually instead worked and staffed the auditor at an official event the day earlier. She has apologized for this error and mistake and will be retrained on proper timekeeping, Luong Tat said in a statement. He added that DiZoglio's office is also retraining its interns on ethics and political finance laws and the importance of preventing the appearance of potential conflict. Aides to state representatives and senators, too, have filed signatures for their bosses' campaigns. John Walsh, the chief of staff of Mariano, the House's top Democrat, submitted paperwork twice in Quincy during workdays in March and once in Weymouth on April 6th. Anna Vivas, a Mariano spokesperson, declined to share Walsh's timesheet, but said he took personal time to volunteer for the speaker's political campaign, which is reflected in his timesheets and permitted under state law. The speaker did not require John to do this as part of his position as a House employee, Vivas said. Aides to state senators Paul Feeney of Foxborough, Mark Montigny of New Bedford, and Patrick O'Connor of Weymouth, as well as State Representative Jeff Turkle of Winthrop, also dropped off nomination papers in Weymouth, Canton, Dartmouth, Winthrop, and Revere, records show. All 4 lawmakers' offices said the aides were not on public time when they filed signatures. Greg Denton, O'Connor's chief of staff, said he believed he was using earned comp time and on my free time when he submitted signatures for his boss in Weymouth in March and April. If I did not think that, I would not have dropped them off, Denton said in a statement. O'Connor said his staff His staff members work 60 to 65 hours a week that they don't eat lunch, and in turn accumulated a tremendous amount of comp time. He also described the process of submitting signatures as an in-and-out one-minute thing. The papers will be hanging around the office, O'Connor said. It's just one of those things. If they are hanging around and there's Weymouth on the way, the aide will drop them off. That article again by Chris Van Buskirk. Thank God I found the second half of it. All right, what else do we have in today's Boston Globe? Let's take a peek for our next story. We'll go to the Nation's pages at this point. Under furious over costs, youths turn to housing crisis. They find a driving cause in issue, worries for future. It's an article by Troy Clausen of the New York Times News Service. It's Dateline New York. On a liberal arts campus with an Irish dance troupe and a contemporary science fiction club, Angelo Mazza recently fell into a singularly niche pastime, reading up on archaic zoning laws. Would seem a curious obsession for a college sophomore, but Naza, who is 19, was born and raised in New York, one of the world's costliest cities. He's watched as a housing crunch on his hometown exploded into a full-blown crisis. So with a friend, Mazza formed a student-led organization last year that breaks down in-the-weeds zoning and policy debates for a youth audience. We're young, but we're getting older, said Mazza, a Fordham University student who lives with his Italian immigrant parents in Queens. It sounds weird coming from a young person, but the next generation is going to have to pay attention to housing. Generations of young people have taken up a cause and stood at the vanguard of movements for change. College students were pioneers of the Vietnam War protest movement. 16 and 17-year-olds rallied at congressional offices after a gunman's rampage at a Parkland, Florida high school. And people in their 20s fought fossil fuel companies anxious that climate change would derail their lives. If every group of young people has its driving cause, this one might be boiled down to six words. The rent is too damn high. That's the only thing I hear now, said Samantha Bravo, 21, who was raised in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, and worries that housing costs are at a breaking point for young New Yorkers starting their lives. Every single day, I think about it. Bravo was 11 when she started testifying at the city's rent guidelines board hearings, as her family routinely lacked heat and water and clashed with the landlord. It's just so frustrating and disheartening. We're the culture of the city. We deserve to be here, she said. Older adults have traditionally been the face of grassroots housing campaigns and tenant groups. Today, young people who have never signed their own apartment leases are jumping into the movement in surprising ways. Teens are coding websites to help neighbors find affordable housing. College sophomores are joining picket lines to protest unaffordable off-campus housing. Students at Columbia University and the University of Texas at Austin started their own tenant unions. There's no large-scale youth housing campaign akin to the Sunrise Movement, the climate activist group, or March for Our Lives, which summoned students to Washington to rally for gun control legislation. But the pent-up frustration among the country's youngest residents appears destined to shape the politics of a generation. In this spring's Harvard Youth Poll, 4 in 10 young Americans agreed that housing costs are snowballing into a national emergency. No other issue, except for inflation, ranked as an urgent crisis for broad shares of 18 to 29-year-olds. They were born into or grew up during a housing crash, sometimes watching as their families lost homes to foreclosure amid the financial collapse of the 2000s. They spent months stuck inside the most dire global health crisis in a century, and then witnessed weather disasters force their friends into hotels and emergency shelters. Now they see a future in which they can barely afford a place to sleep. John Delavolpe, director of polling at Harvard University's Institute of Politics, regularly hosts small focus groups across the nation. Without fail, at least one young person shares a harrowing story. They're homeless or deeply afraid of becoming homeless. As many as two-thirds of Generation Z renters across the nation struggle to afford housing. This according to polls and surveys. Also from today's Nation's pages, we have this. As scammers get better, banks to adapt safeguards. Tellers now key parts of fraud prevention. This article by Tara Siegel-Bernard, again of the New York Times News Service, is datelined out of Scarsdale, New York. Karen Batista and Angela Castaldo have spent a combined 47 years behind the teller counter at a Chase branch in Scarsdale, an affluent suburb just north of Manhattan. They know which customers just returned from vacation, whose children were recently married, and who just lost a beloved dog. Just before closing time on a cold February afternoon, one of their longtime customers, then 81 and recently widowed, walked up to Batista's station. The woman needed to transfer $9,000 into a new account. She slid her debit card into the reader on the counter, but when Batista searched for a new account under her name, nothing came up. What the customer shared next provided some clues. Before coming in, she said, she received a call from Chase. At least, that's what it said on her cell phone's caller ID. The caller asked if she had made 3 transfers for $1,000 each via Zelle, the bank's digital payment service, something she had never used. The caller then transferred the customer to a man who called himself Michael, and who said he would open a new account for her to safeguard her money from fraudsters. But she'd have to get into a branch to transfer $9,000 into that new account. After digesting the details, Batista asked for the new account number and plugged it into the bank system. A man's name appeared. "Hold on a second," Batista recalled, saying, "If you take this money out and put it, this money into this account, then that's it for your money. So I should hang up with him?" the customer asked. Batista didn't realize this Michael had been listening on the woman's cell phone the entire time. Many criminals in these schemes are known for coaching their victims through their cons. "Yes, hang up the phone," Batista said. She had prevented the customer from falling for a bank's impersonation scam. Castaldo, her coworker, had also assisted another branch employee with a $22,000 save. Many others don't have the benefit of trusted tellers to stand between them and their scammer, And even when they do, many people still become embroiled in these schemes. In 2025, cybercrime losses of $21 billion were reported, up more than 25% from 2024, and nearly five times the $4.4 billion reported in 2020. This, according to the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center. Many more cybercrimes go unreported. The Scarsdale bankers and many of their colleagues at teller windows and call centers across the country have taken up new roles. They are often detectives, psychologists, and when everything goes right, even fraud-fighting heroes, saving customers from losing their hard-earned money to criminals. Financial institutions always dedicated substantial infrastructure to fighting fraud, but cybercrime has become so pervasive that many are increasing their investments or experimenting with new strategies. J.P. Morgan Chase, the nation's largest bank, is training staff to address the fraudsters' psychological tactics head-on. Chase realized that the most effective way to fight back may be to better understand the emotional and psychological dynamics. So it hired Elizabeth Huppert, a behavioral scientist, roughly 2 years ago. Since then, she has been leading experiments with so-called scam interruption teams to develop strategies to assist call center staff and branch employees. These specialists swoop in when they determine that a criminal is stringing someone along, based, for example, on data and behaviors tracked behind the scenes or tells given inside a branch. Their jobs are often fraught. They may be the first to break the news that a customer's investment returns are entirely an illusion, or that a new girlfriend isn't who she seems. Many scammers, who are often trained in criminal syndicate compounds overseas, develop deep relationships with their victims, often over many months. Targets may be prodded into a heightened emotional state, which is often compared to being entranced under a spell. Huppert is trying to develop ways to put those spells in flux, as she said in a recent interview. She studied calls with customers to try to better understand why they're receptive to the scammer stories and learned that they are often conditioned to distrust the bank. The scam specialists are being trained to flip that script, largely by raising questions and casting doubt, then finding ways to change the customer's behavior. Also, and now we turn to the world pages in a very interesting headline. Spain, enraptured, greets Pope Bad Bunny. Yes, again, Spain enraptured, greets Pope Bad Bunny. A buoyant Leo draws throngs to mass message. An article that was written by Anthony Fiola of the Washington Post staff, Stateline Madrid. This past weekend, icons of faith and pop culture have circled each other in the Spanish capital like celestial bodies drawn close by gravity. One, the first U.S.-born pope, a leader of 1.4 billion Catholics. The other, Bad Bunny, the Puerto Rican singer, whose gospel of reggaeton has racked up more than 123 billion streams on Spotify. Madrid, all of Spain, and the celebrity-obsessed press have pondered the possibility of a supernova encounter, with Bad Bunny having requested to meet the Holy Father, according to a person familiar with his interest. Either way, something special took shape on Pope Leo first official trip to a major Catholic country in the West. The stoic Chicagoan, who began his papacy with the body language of an introvert, was displaying the makings of his own star turn. In Spain, which has grown widely secular in recent decades and is one of the world's most socially progressive nations, Leo drew an estimated 500,000 people Saturday night for a youth concert and prayer vigil, and 1.1 million for a sprawling open-air mass Sunday that brought parts of Madrid to a standstill. These were some of the biggest crowds of his 13-month papacy, 2 days into a 7-day trip. His totals far exceed the half million fans paying upward of $80 a pop for Bad Bunny's 10-night run of concerts in Madrid. At the start of his papacy, and on his first foreign trip to Turkey and Lebanon last year, Leo was sometimes stiff and stilted, but the man emerging from the Pope Mobile in Spain, moving through the crowds in pristine white with a motive assurance, holding babies, hugging disabled people, blessing foreheads, seems transformed. On stage, Leo, speaking fluent Spanish, seems more affecting, more natural, sometimes stirring the faithful to tears. "He's found his stride," said Elise Ann Allen, a Vatican journalist and author of a biography of Leo, nodding and smiling as she watched him on stage Saturday evening. Leo, who's 70 years old, has grown increasingly vocal in his opposition to the war in Iran, and his role as a foil to President Trump has elevated his global stature, but observers also see a Pope who is more inspirational at ground level, with his speeches moving throngs in Africa this past April. Last month, Leo's first encyclical, centered on the morality of artificial intelligence, stirred global reflection, with disparate politicians, including Vice President J.D. Vance and Spain's liberal Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, quoting his work. Popular acclaim does not come easily to all popes. During his 26 years as pontiff, much of it spanning the late 20th century, Pope John Paul II was seen by scholars to connect with the masses in an especially powerful and transformative way, and he is often credited with aiding the fall of communism. Francis, the first New World Pope, was endowed with, or suffered from, depending on the point of view, an excess of personality. Leo is beginning to show Francis' level of social engagement, combined with the balanced and thoughtful attitude of Paul VI, said Marco Politi, a Rome-based author of several books on the Vatican. "We'll see surprises in his papacy," as one Vatican Monsignor said, using the last name the Pope was born with. "Prevost has more in his storage room than he showed in the shop window." The artistic power of Bad Bunny's global megastar and ambassador of Hispanic youth culture is to mesmerize, to feel linked. The same can be said of the Pope, charged with inspiring the faithful. Leo, aboard the papal flight, noted that he would be competing for attention with Bad Bunny in Madrid. Leo said he hoped young people are looking for something more than a spiritual dimension in their lives. They realize there's an emptiness and a lack of sense of meaning. If they are confronted with the question, do they want to see Bad Bunny or do they want to see the Pope, I think many will see Bad Bunny, Leo said. But I think there will also be a few here to see the Pope. And that says something. Next, from today's Boston Globe and the World pages, we have this story under the daily briefing section. Zelensky insists Europe play key role in peace talks. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky insisted Sunday that Europe must play a key role in any negotiations to end the war with Russia as he arrived for talks in London with key European allies. Ahead of the meeting hosted by British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, Zelensky said the talks will focus on further efforts to help Ukraine's war effort, including air defense. Europe must be part of the negotiations and must be strong, he said on X. Also present at the meeting at number 10 Downing Street are French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. The UK, France, and Germany, the so-called E3 group of Europe nations, have been prominent backers of Ukraine following Russia's full-scale invasion in February of 2022. The UK and France lead the coalition of the willing. That's an initiative to provide security guarantees for Ukraine as part of a peace process. The meeting comes after a Russian drone strike killed three people waiting at a bus stop in southeastern Ukraine. Also, this story from today's Globe under the briefing section of the World pages. 7.8 magnitude earthquake rattles the Philippines. Dateline Manila. A magnitude 7.8 earthquake centered at sea shook part of southern Philippines early Monday, causing damage in a key coastal city, knocking out power and sending 3-foot tsunami waves along nearby coasts, officials said. President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. asked people to immediately go to higher ground in the Philippines areas vulnerable to a tsunami, and Indonesian and Malaysian authorities also issued warnings to their coastal areas. There were no immediate reports of casualties. It was not clear if people were trapped or injured in the collapse of at least one small building in General Santos, a tuna processing city of 700,000 people in the south. The strongest earthquake to hit the Philippines this year was centered at sea about 8 miles southwest of General Santos and was caused by movement in the Cotabato Trench at a depth of 6 miles. This, according to Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology. Also, from today's Boston Globe, we have this story from the Congo. Hazard pay in Congo was slim to none. Ebola health workers risk it all to stop the spread. This is Dateline, Mongwalu, Congo. It's an article by Justin Kabumba and Ope Odeteo. Dr. Richard Lukudu, the medical director of the Mongwalu General Referral Hospital, has received barely any compensation for his work on the front lines of one of the Congo's deadliest Ebola virus outbreaks. Lukudu and several of his colleagues work all day at the hospital treating an influx of patients. Notifications of suspected cases come even late at night. I have not received my allowance, and what happened to others could happen to me as well, Lukudu said in an interview. Despite all the infection prevention and control measures we are implementing, we do not know what may happen. Health authorities believe the outbreak started in the bustling mining area of Mongwalu in Ituri province there. Mining conditions conducive to virus spread in that region has emerged as the epicenter of the rare Bundibugyo type. The town attracts large numbers of laborers who work in large gold mines with muddy pools of gold deposits, narrow pits and caves. They live in low-income areas, including crowded camps, and have little access to health protocols. The conditions increase the possibility of transmitting the disease, which spreads through close contact with bodily fluids of the sick and deceased, such as sweat, blood, feces, and vomit. There also has been widespread skepticism regarding the disease, making the job of medical treatment more difficult for Lokudu and his colleagues, while some of the health workers and first responders have also died from the disease. It is one thing to be far away and hear statistics being reported, but what is happening on the ground is enormous, Lokudu said. People are sacrificing their rest and comfort for this cause. There should be recognition that they deserve compensation. These workers should receive their salaries regularly. The Congolese government did not respond to a request for comment. Minimal resources available. Congolese authorities have confirmed 452 cases, including 82 deaths. On Thursday, the Central African nation recorded 71 new cases in a day, which authorities said is a sign of active community transmission. The rare Bundibugyo type has no approved vaccines or treatment, so health workers have been targeting symptoms. The government said at least 5 people have recovered from Ebola since the outbreak was officially confirmed by the Congo's Ministry of Health on May 15th. The disease had a big head start, according to the World Health Organization, its director, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. Hospitals in the region could not test for the right type of Ebola that had begun spreading several weeks before confirmation. Health workers are handling the disease with minimal resources as agencies have been scrambling to bring aid into the region. Masks, gloves, boots, and medications were initially all in short supply. There has been an erosion of the health system, said Heather Kerr, country director of the International Rescue Committee in Congo. There has not been investment in the health system, and this has been going on for years. Tough conditions for health workers. During the first week, we did not even have time to go home and eat. The second week was the same. We only eat once a day, what amounts to breakfast in the evening, said Alice Bumshunga, a nurse at the Mongbalwalu Hospital. Even with widespread skepticism and disregard for health protocols, many in the town are becoming aware of the outbreak's grave reality. Asero Jean had 5 children. 2 died from the disease within 2 weeks. When her daughter became ill, the family thought it was malaria, and neighbors advised them to avoid the hospital, saying anyone who went to the hospital would die immediately. This according to Jean, age 52. The daughter died after 3 weeks of moving between the hospitals and home, followed by a son who died days after. Then Jean became sick. I saw about 20 people die, Jean said. I watched them being taken to the morgue, yet God is allowing me to leave here alive. I thank the doctors. The World Health Organization offers a plan. Tedros, the World Health Organization Director General, on Friday launched a $518 million plan to combat the outbreak, saying containing Ebola depends on political commitment, sustained financing, and the trust and engagement of communities. For health workers on the front line of Congo's Ebola outbreak, the work has become harder as the disease spreads faster than their current treatment capacity. Despite the alert we receive and the teams we have on site, we lack the means to travel into the field, Lakudu said. As a result, there are our alerts. We are unable to investigate. Also, from today's Boston Globe, we have these stories from the Nation's pages under the Daily Briefing section. This police search for suspects in Ohio shooting that wounded 12 near a street festival. Police had no suspects in custody Sunday after a weekend shooting near an Ohio street festival wounded 12 people and sent attendees scrambling for cover in a busy Toledo neighborhood. Toledo Deputy Police Chief Joe Heffernan said it appeared that at least two people fired weapons on Saturday near the Old West End Festival and were probably shooting at each other. Multiple videos posted to social media showed people running amid the sound of gunshots and emergency officials tending to others who appeared wounded. As the search for the shooters wore on, Lucas County prosecutor, Julia Bates vowed, justice will be swift and strong. Those who were frightened, traumatized, or harmed by this violence will remain at the forefront of our efforts. I've felt outraged before, but this is personal, Bates said in a statement. This is my home. These are my friends and neighbors. It is not okay. Authorities say a search for the shooters was ongoing and had not identified any potential suspects. They urged festival goers to come forward with any photos or videos. As far as violence, this is over the top, right? Toledo Police Lieutenant Dan Gerken said. 12 people being shot, that's the most I've been to at a scene. I've been to a lot of scenes, but this is way over the top. Speaking of over the top, this story, 5 people injured in stabbings at New York City's Penn Station. 5 people were injured after a series of stabbings at New York's Penn Station on Sunday evening, and a suspect is in custody, authorities said. Paramedics responded at around 7 p.m. and found one victim with a serious injury, 2 with moderate injuries, and the rest with minor injuries, the city's fire department said in a statement. All were transported to Bellevue Hospital. The fire department said the suspect was in custody without elaborating. The stabbings occurred in one of the city's busiest transit hubs on the eve of President Trump's planned attendance at Game 3 of the NBA Championship Series at Madison Square Garden, which sits directly above Penn Station. The presidential visit has already prompted heightened security measures around the arena and surrounding blocks, with the Secret Service, New York Police Department, and other agencies expected to have a substantial presence for the nationally televised event. Authorities did not immediately indicate whether the stabbing incident would affect security plans for Monday night's game, but the violence unfolded in an area where millions of commuters, tourists, and sports fans pass through each year. Penn Station is expected to be particularly crowded ahead of the first NBA Finals game at Madison Square Garden since 1999. Also, from today's Boston Globe, we have this story under the business section from Talking Points. GE sees potential for more China deals after Trump-Z meeting. GE Aerospace remains optimistic that it can secure more aircraft engine orders from China after President Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping met in Beijing last month, and manufacturing partner Boeing Company came home with an initial batch of commitments. A Chinese proposal to purchase 200 Boeing jets was an important first step toward reopening sales in the country, GE Chief Executive Larry Culp said on Sunday. I think the foundation was laid. The door is open, Culp said. GE plans trip to the U.S. in September could lead to additional orders for Boeing and GE. GE continues to see strong demand for its aircraft engines and spare parts from airlines around the world, despite concerns about surging fuel prices denting demand for air travel. GE expects spare part demand to grow 40% in 2026 as airlines prepare for the expected rebound in demand when the U.S. war in Iran ends, Culp said. The lessons from the pandemic were things come back, they come back stronger, the executive said. Also, we have this from Talking Points. Fed's Barr warns of risks tied to looser Wall Street bank rules. Federal Reserve Governor Michael Barr criticized moves from regulators over the past year to relax the rule for U.S. leaders, saying the proposals considerably weaken bank regulation and supervision. I believe that recent steps by the Federal Reserve and other agencies will undermine the safety and soundness of banks and increase financial stability risks, Barr said on Saturday. Vulnerabilities that result from deregulation may not be apparent today, but they will result in problems that will build over the coming years and could threaten serious harm to the economy. Trump-era officials have made changes to loosen the rules for Wall Street lenders, including relaxing how much capital big banks must hold as a buffer against potential losses, narrowing the scope of supervision, and laying out a path for traditional lenders to better compete with private credit giants. That has resulted in a series of wins for the banking industry under Fed Vice Chair Supervisor Michelle Bowman, who took over the role a year ago. She was nominated to be the Fed's top bank cop after Barr resigned from that role in a bid to bypass a potential battle with President Trump over the position. Barr warned that weaker capital rules, liquidity requirements, and oversight can increase risks of bank stress. Also, from today's Boston Globe, we have this from the Talking Points section. Scary movie reboot tops Masters of the Universe. After 3 weeks of indie horror dominance at the box office, the slasher spoof Scary Movie topped ticket sales with $55 million over the weekend, according to studio estimates Sunday, easily besting the far from mighty Masters of the Universe. A new order has lately come to movie theaters, which have seen Gen Z ticket buyers flock to the horror hits Obsession and Back Rooms, both made by YouTubers turned filmmakers. Those movies have even outshone the Walt Disney Company, Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu. This week in comedy was the underdog champ. Though the genre has been all but left for dead in theaters, the sixth Scary Movie notched a franchise best 105.5 million global launch. Very interesting. Well, let's look at the globe for this Monday morning. And we hope you all have great weeks in the week ahead. Sunshine will be our friend today, the next few days, and then chance of thunderstorms later in the week. Temperatures will rise and humidity will as well as we move through the week, really bringing a real feel of summer to us. The weekend, which is far away at this point, but forecasters are saying Saturday and Sunday could be bright sunshine, kind of against the trend we've had lately, which will be nice to enjoy. So, like I said, have great weeks. Thank you for your ongoing support of the Talking Information Center. Hopefully we can continue to provide to you what you want and need as we move through the year. Talk again soon.